from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn how one local organization is preparing to support Afghan refugees coming to Wisconsin. Then we'll learn about Diverse and Resilience 414 All program and its mission to promote sexual health in Milwaukee.
The goal in it is to normalize conversations around condom usage, around sexual health, around the wellness of your entire body. And I strongly believe that's something that 414 All has been able to do within Milwaukee.
Plus, the Milwaukee Public Library shares a list of book recommendations for adults and kids who want to learn more about racism.
You know, I've had to, especially recently, have those tough conversations. And I found this book list to be helpful to me in explaining some of those things to my children.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start with this. There are a couple thousand Afghan refugees being housed at Fort McCoy in western Wisconsin. These refugees fled their homes under urgent and dangerous circumstances. They've arrived in a place where many people may not speak their language or practice their customs, and they may feel unsure about the future. This is undoubtedly a traumatic and difficult time for these people, but Hector Colon wants to help alleviate some of that stress. He's the president and CEO of Lutheran Social Services of Wisconsin and Upper Michigan. His organization will be working to help resettle refugees in Wisconsin. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver and begins by explaining what he knows about Fort McCoy.
What I do know, there will be many that will be at Fort McCoy, and some of which could be resettled in Wisconsin, but that does not mean that all of them would be resettled in Wisconsin. So there are service providers all across the country that could be accepting and receiving these individuals and providing them opportunities to resettle really across the country.
And based on past experience with other refugee populations coming to the United States, do we have any idea how long these refugees will be temporarily at Fort McCoy?
This is kind of a new situation for us. That's an extreme emergency. So I would not be able to answer that. I really don't know. I'm sure they want to do it as quickly as possible, but they also want to do it safely. And a big part of the process is to ensure that they can connect these individuals with organizations that can provide them with the best level of care, but also, if possible, connect them to family or places and organizations that have a connection to their cultures. So all of those things need to be taken into consideration when resettling these individuals.
What kind of assistance will refugees need when they get settled in communities, when they finally get the chance to leave places like Fort McCoy?
Yeah, so we set them up very quickly with housing, with food, with clothing, getting their children enrolled in school, English language training, job services and placement. So we work very quickly to integrate these individuals into the community. We usually provide these services for a year. We can continue to provide these services for an additional 4 years, but many of these individuals get fully integrated very quickly, learn English, have a job, even become citizens shortly after a year, and end up loving the United States of America very much.
What are some of the things people might not realize about refugee populations' needs, like when they first arrive and are here for the first year or two?
Yeah, so obviously language, cultural, and customs. And so one of the things that LIRS likes to do is connect these individuals to organizations that have the cultural intelligence. They might resettle close to where they might have other family members or more of the cultural experience from where they come from. So those are all considerations that are very important. You know, other things is that these individuals have experienced, in some cases, extreme trauma, especially the children. So one of the things that we are very mindful of is how do we make sure that we can serve that as well.
Have you started specifically thinking about the Afghan refugees and what sort of specific assistance and cultural access that they will need?
Yes, we're having conversations with lots of organizations. For example, the UW system, we've engaged with them, and there's a willingness to try to help with English as a second language. So we're in conversations with them. We also just had a conversation with MATC that wants to also play an active role. And so they're out trying to develop and get resources to help us, again, with language, culture, and housing. So this really relies on getting connected with lots of partners that will help us make sure that we serve these individuals well right here in Wisconsin.
Afghanistan is like 99% Muslim, for instance, and Wisconsin is maybe like under 1%. Are you connecting with Muslim organizations as well?
Yes, that would be a part of the process, an individual's religion, their background. We want to make sure that we're trying to integrate them into America, but also making sure that we can make connections to their culture so that it's the best process for them in integrating here into Wisconsin.
And how is the pandemic playing a role in refugee resettlement?
The pandemic has really affected us in lots of different ways. So I think similar to other situations with the pandemic, it becomes a little more difficult because there's a heightened awareness of safety and the vaccine and social distancing, and all of those things play a role. So it's top of mind right now, the COVID situation on all of our programs, not just refugee, but serving people with addiction and severe persistent mental illness and foster care and the elderly. So it's COVID is part of our life right now.
You know, there are steps that the federal government has taken to help the American population overall. Eviction moratorium was in place for a while. There's been unemployment insurance. There's been paycheck protection programs for small businesses. What are some of the things that economically these refugees are going to have access to in this sort of strange, difficult pandemic?
Yeah, there is some resources available to them for housing, but it's very nominal. So that's why we need to fundraise to help these individuals make sure that they can obtain housing for at least a year. You know, it might take that amount of time for an individual to learn English and get integrated and find a job. Oftentimes it happens much quicker than that, and in fact most times it does, but there could be situations where individuals need a little bit of help that that the government assistance can't sustain, so that's where we, our fundraising dollars, can help with those individuals with housing and other basic needs.
And I'm imagining there's no one trajectory for a refugee in terms of finding a job, getting settled economically. People come with different skills, different backgrounds, different education levels. Is there tailored assistance for people?
Yeah, no, great question. And it really is a person-centered approach. Like you said, some individuals come with great capacity and education and expertise and certain industries, and we connect them to those industries just like you would anybody else here in the United States of America. So depending on their interests, their skills, their background, we try to make those connections and leverage so that we can get them integrated quickly into society and help them obtain a job that they would enjoy.
And we've talked a little bit about the context of the pandemic playing a role in resettlement. What about the political climate that we've been in? During the Trump presidency, there were significant cuts to refugee resettlement overall and to support for resettlement agencies. How has that affected the climate that you're finding yourself in?
Yeah, thank you. It's a tough situation. So there are many organizations that got out of refugee services because of the numbers were substantially reduced under the Trump administration. So basically, they were no longer sustainable. We faced those similar challenges, and we had conversations about the refugee program. We decided that we wanted to stay in the refugee program, and we tried to right-size the organization, which is really hard because you might not be able to accept as many individuals, but then you have to provide those individuals with support for up to 5 years, so you need staff. So it's kind of hard to right size. We tried that, we did a little bit of that, but we supplemented our government funding with philanthropy to really help us stay in this program. The board is very committed to this program. The leadership team, the organization is very committed to this program. That's why we've been fundraising to ensure that we can run this program in a sustainable way and help many people who need our help, especially now more than ever.
And what did you mean by right size?
Cut our staff because we were receiving many less refugees. So for example, before we would receive 100 to 300 refugees on an annual basis, actually more in the 300 range, And the Trump administration decreased the number of refugees coming into the country at 15,000. So that really impacted the number of individuals that were available to be served amongst all the organizations across the country. So we did have to downsize our staff a little bit, but we're still losing money in the program. And again, we supplemented those losses with philanthropy, with individuals that were very passionate about this program, knowing that these individuals come from very dire situations, fleeing from war, persecution, genocide, very sad situations. So for us to be here to love these individuals, to care for them, and provide them with an opportunity to live in peace, freedom, and prosperity is something that is core to who we are as an organization.
And what do you think that the downsizing in the overall infrastructure to help refugees around the country and in Wisconsin is going to mean for such refugee crises as what's happening in Afghanistan and for refugees coming into the United States going forward?
Yeah, great question. It's gonna be difficult for all of us. So Biden did increase the number of refugees that come into the country from 15,000 over 62,000. So we were trying to develop the capacity to get back to serving over 300 refugees. So that was taking some resources, and so we can add staff and interpreters to just accommodate the increased number of refugees that were going to come to us anyway. On top of that, now you have the Afghan situation, which places even more challenges for us. But organizations like ours rise to the occasion, and we will do what we need to do. We've been so blessed to have, we're getting lots of calls from donors that want to support us. And we're on a path to try to raise at least $500,000 specifically relating to the Afghan population, and another $350,000 just to get ready to serve more refugees, generally speaking. So it's going to require support from the community, but we're very confident that individuals in the community recognize the need and will respond.
Hector Colon of Lutheran Social Services, thanks for talking to us about the refugee situation.
Thank you so much. It's an honor and privilege to be on your show and appreciate it very much.
Hector Colon is the president and CEO of Lutheran Social Services of Wisconsin and Upper Michigan. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver about his organization's plans to help resettle Afghan refugees. Diverse and Resilience 414 All program is the largest condom distributor in Milwaukee. Earlier this month, the program was in jeopardy of ending due to a lack of funding. But a grant from the United Way of Greater Milwaukee prevented that from happening. Since 2014, the program has distributed over 1 million condoms, and it hopes to continue by providing sexual health education to their more than 50 community partners. Osha Towers is the director of community organizing at Diverse and Resilient. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang about the impact of this program.
The 411 for All program started back in February of 2014, and it really started as a program to address teen pregnancy going on in Milwaukee, and also the fact that Milwaukee, for the past several years, has been ranked nationwide for chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, and also having this cluster of HIV as well. So wanting to make sure that not only are we tackling the teen pregnancy rates in Milwaukee, but we're also making sure that our young folks are engaging in sex that's using protective barriers. So that includes condoms, that includes insertable condoms, dental dams, everything. And we also distribute lube out to folks. So it really started with knowing that there is the significant need, but not seeing where that access to protective barriers is at for folks, where they can easily get it. I think it's really important to just recognize the fact that the 411 for All program is not only for young people. Our priorities have been for young folks, but also for our sex workers and community, and also just for everybody to be able to get access to this, because we know this is important and that sex and sexual health should be normalized in our community across the board.
Relatively recently, you all almost had to close the program and shut down the program because of a lack of funding, but thankfully received a grant to stay afloat. Mm-hmm. So I just want to ask too, you mentioned this, that the program was started to prevent teen pregnancy and to really prevent sexually transmitted infections from transmitting throughout the city. According to the City of Milwaukee Health Department, they have seen a significant increase in syphilis and other sexually transmitted diseases like chlamydia and gonorrhea. And 414 All, you all provide condom education to over 50 community partners like schools, barbershops, and restaurants. Just right off the bat, what are some common misconceptions about condoms and why do people opt out to use them?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say one of the first things is this thought that condoms don't feel good, that people don't really enjoy using condoms. There's also this belief around just being able to have that trust with the other person that you're engaging with sex with, that you should just be able to know that person is telling you the truth and that they don't have anything. But the reality is that given the fact that sexually transmitted infections often don't have symptoms, so many people don't know for themselves, because testing is another piece of making sure that folks not only have condoms, but folks are also getting tested. So I would say that for me, those are some of the top things that come up. When we're specifically talking about young folks, though, one of the biggest things that I struggle with is the amount of parents and other adults in young folks' lives that say that they're just not there yet. You know, they're not even thinking about sex at all. So why would I have a conversation with them? Why would I give them condoms? But the reality is that there's no harm in even just young kids having condoms. They get this really important lesson for them that they can carry on whether they engage in sex the next day or in 5 years.
I do want to ask too, when you're going into these community partner spaces, what do you generally talk to folks once you're there?
Well, everyone gets a training. So the first thing is to make sure that people are aware of what we offer and that they're willing to have that conversation with other people and that they're going to be a non-judgmental space where people can easily access the condoms that are available to them. Often, one of the things that we hear from young folks especially is that it's like, yeah, technically, I guess my school has condoms, but it's way out. Nobody really knows. It's like behind a locked door and you have to know Johnny in order to get to them. Right? Or there's only one person that's really willing to talk about condoms or about sex with you, right? So instead of making all these extra obstacles for folks, really making sure that our partners, at least, are people that are going to have at least like a bowl or something that's open and right out front. Everybody can get to it. Nobody has to check out condoms or anything like that. It doesn't have to be this long process. It can just be something where people grab some condoms and walk away. And one thing that I want to add in this too is that within those condom packs are 5 different types of condoms and 2 different types of lubes and a little informational sheet. So that kind of takes away some of that pressure from other partners as well for having to find like just the right ones for people or go through the steps of explaining absolutely everything. It can just be something where people get that pack and have everything that they need right there. So that's like our first step with partners and to be able to explain that as well to them.
When you said like you're checking it out from Johnny, I just started laughing because condoms aren't a library book, but it kind of feels like it's very formal and bureaucratic when it's at school. And that's really scary for a young person, mm-hmm. I would say. I just want to ask too, how many condoms has 414 All distributed since the opening and the start of the program?
We distributed over 1 million condoms since 2014 and actually over 200,000 condoms just last year.
What is the impact of the 414 All Diverse and Resilient program of distributing the condoms? And what has the impact been within the community around the topics of sex education and condom education?
Just having folks around the county that know where to be able to get condoms, that know that that's something that they have every right to, just as anybody else. And the goal in it is to normalize conversations around condom usage, around sexual health, around the wellness of your entire body. That includes sex as a piece of that. And I strongly believe that's something that 414 All has been able to do within Milwaukee.
People who are listening who want to help and volunteer, how can people sign up and what would you be doing?
One of the biggest things is to be able to help pack condoms. And then outside of the packing process, which is incredibly helpful for us, because again, we distribute not just condoms and like 50 at a time, we distribute entire bins with 200 condoms inside of there. So starting with the packing process and then helping out at events, be able to join. I would love to see more folks once we're past COVID and in a better world to be able to come out and join events and distribute with us or play the games. Like I said, we have cards where we ask questions about STIs and about sexual health and condom usage. So just being more involved in community and knowing that even if that's not necessarily an option for folks, one of the other things that we've had is just people that want to also be a part of distributing for themselves, just going up and down the neighborhood or talking to their friends and picking up some condoms, whatever it may be, or being a new site. So there's plenty of opportunities where everybody is able to get involved in whatever capacity they have.
And where can Milwaukeeans pick up condoms from you all?
If anyone is interested, you can definitely go online to the Diverse and Resilient page or directly to the 414 All MKE Milwaukee condom distribution page. And on there, you'll see that there's an email that you can just easily click on and send a message our way. I've also seen more folks that are reaching out about donating. I highly appreciate any love and support that we can get as well.
Thank you so much, Osha, for being here on Lake Effect with me. I really appreciate you and all the work that 414 All is doing.
Oh, I appreciate you too. Thank you for having me.
Osha Towers is the Director of Community Organizing at Diverse and Resilient. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll share a list of books that can help adults and children learn more about race and racism. But first, we'll look at some of the many events happening this month in Milwaukee. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As schools are starting up and the summer is winding down, there are a lot of opportunities to get out and enjoy the great weather while we still have it. Adam Carr from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service joins us every month to talk about some of the many community events happening here in the city. Adam, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me. I can't believe it's September already.
It's already September. We're hopefully getting out of the extreme heat and into a little nicer weather. Some of these things are going to be outside, in fact, so the cooler weather could be great. But the first event that we're going to be talking about is something that I think has happened for a number of years now. And this year, it's Milwaukee Film as well as X Fabula.
You know, the Cultures and Communities Festival, which is part of Milwaukee Film's offerings throughout the year, is taking place from September 6th through the 12th. And as usual, they have a bunch of incredible events lined up, a bunch of incredible films, obviously. And I just wanted to call one out. They have coming up on Friday, September 10th. It's an event named Around the Table, Stories of Food and Culture. They're doing it in collaboration with X Fabula, and it's at No Studios. So No Studios, if you haven't been, it's always a great place to visit. And X Fabula, which has done incredible storytelling for a long time now in Milwaukee, they're curating a culinary-themed story slam. And I think, you know, every time they have a theme, it's something interesting to talk about. And I think food and stories of food, they draw out incredible stories. So that's taking place Friday, September 10th at 7 p.m. Around the Table, Stories of Food and Culture with X Fabula, part of the Cultures and Community Festival from Milwaukee Film.
Interestingly enough, the next event that we're going to be looking at is another festival. Instead of maybe a communities festival, an international festival, although it will be in our community.
Yes, it's the Silver City International Festival, which has been happening for a number of years. And this past year, in 2020, they did kind of a mobile festival where they did performances in the street. And this year, they're returning to an in-person festival. It's not taking place in National Avenue, where it often takes place. It's happening at Arlington Heights Park, right on between 35th and 34th in Pierce. And what it is, Silver City International Festival, is a celebration of the cultural diversity of the neighborhood. So there's all different kinds of food, art, music. In my opinion, it's one of the most family-friendly events anywhere in Milwaukee throughout the year. Every time I go, there's kids, there's parents, there's grandparents, there's everybody. And this year, actually, our plan is, if things go to plan, Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, we did this project a couple years ago where we brought out a vintage couch and took pictures of people at a few events around the summer. And our plan is to bring it to the Silver City International Festival. So look for us there. So this is Saturday, September 11th. We'll be there with our couch taking photos of people, including with a Polaroid camera. So the Silver City International Festival 2021 is right around the corner.
As you mentioned, Silver City and the surrounding neighborhoods are incredibly diverse. When we're talking about the different cultures that will be represented at this international festival, what are we talking about?
You know, on National Avenue alone, there are Lao and Thai restaurants. There's a Puerto Rican restaurant. There's a Mexican restaurant. There's folks really actually from all over the Spanish-speaking world, which is a diverse thing, as well as folks from Southeast Asia, but even further beyond that. So, you know, that's one of my favorite things to do is just stand by the stage and see who's going to come up next, because it might be Aztec dancers and that might then be followed by someone playing reggae music or something like that. So, you know, every year it's always an incredible, diverse lineup.
Our next event is similarly cultural. Instead of people, though, we're talking about plants.
Absolutely. So again, this is also on Saturday, September 11th from 1 to 3 p.m. at Linden Sculpture Garden. They have a series throughout the year called Home, and they have a whole rotating set of programs that happen, all of which are amazing. And on Saturday, September 11th, Angela Kingsawan is doing a cultural plant walk. So Angela is someone I've known for a number of years. I actually met her when she was working at the Gerald L. Ignace Indian Wellness Center. But she's been doing a lot of different community health work throughout the years in Milwaukee. She's from the South Side. and she's an expert on herbs. She actually, in her own backyard, grows a bunch of different plants that she uses as medicines. And Lyndon, if you've been to Lyndon Sculpture Garden, they have these gardens in the back that they call their narrative gardens. And they're fun to walk around in because they're unlike any other thing that I know of in Milwaukee. And she'll be giving guided tours of these places, kind of decoding them, looking for the significance of the plants as food, potentially as medicine in different traditions. So I think I'm really excited that Angela, she's actually doing this. She's doing a series of months. So Angela's doing a bunch of different walks at Lyndon, and the one in September is on the 11th.
It sounds like a really great way to get outside. And actually, all of these events seem to be a great way to get into the community, especially in safer ways where we're walking outside, where we're hanging out in areas that are well circulated, I guess, which is interesting because our next event is, in fact, called Circulate.
Absolutely. And that is at one of my favorite gathering places, no matter even whether the Delta variant's a threat or not, Alice's Garden. So Circulate MKE is a market that the founders of True School put together, as well as a bunch of other different community members, really with the idea of creating a market where dollars that people have in the community circulate within their own community. So all of the vendors, all of the artists, all of the artisans who sell things at these markets are people who are your neighbors. They're folks that whenever I go, they're people I want to support. So on September 25th, they're having their summer market at Alice's Garden. Alice's Garden actually last summer, built a bunch of infrastructure, so tables and other things, to have markets like this. So on Saturday, September 25th, you can go to Circulate MKE Summer Market at Alice's Garden. And, you know, especially that time of year, it's usually like kind of a little past harvest, but it's a great time to be in the market, and it's always a great time to support your neighbors.
For sure. Now, our final event is, I think, a fan favorite, something that people in Milwaukee often look forward to, that is Doors Open.
Yes, Doors Open is back this year. You know, they did a bunch of digital things last year, which is really cool, and they're continuing to expand those offerings. So they have app tours of different neighborhoods, which I think are a great addition to their lineup. But on September 25th and 26th, they're having a bunch of ticketed tours all over the city of a bunch of different topics and geographies and neighborhoods around the city. But they're also doing locations that are open for in-person tours with no ticket required. So kind of the classic Doors Open experience. And, you know, they have a big, long list, not as long as usual. It's a little more limited than normal times, but I looked, you know, there's places like Glorious Malone's Fine Sausage. There's the Islamic Society of Milwaukee, Rosga Family's Old Southside Settlement Museum, the Wisconsin Black Historical Society, these great places that you might drive by or not even know are there, and the opportunity to go inside. Some of these spaces that we, you know, we might know the facades, being able to step foot inside can be mind-blowing. We are actually Neighborhood News Service. We're doing an event in collaboration with Doors Open. We did it last year in the digital format, and we liked it so much we're doing it again. So on the evening of September 30th at 6 p.m., we're doing an event named Neighborhood Gems, which is a showcase of great neighborhood projects. And we give each project exactly 5 minutes to tell their story. So it's pretty rapid fire. And last year, you know, we heard everything from things that were jubilant and joyous and fun to things that were heartwarming and moving. So yeah, there will be a series of your neighbors on September 30th as part of Doors Open, sharing in the Neighborhood Gems program, and that is free to attend.
All right, well, a lot to look forward to this September. Adam, as always, thank you so much for sharing these events.
Absolutely, and we will see you in October.
Adam Carr is the Deputy Editor for Community Engagement at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. Coming up, Hermione Bell Henderson from the Milwaukee Public Library gives us a list of book recommendations that teach readers more about race and racism. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Right now, many of us are engaging in conversations about race and systemic racism in the U.S. In some ways, it's a conversation our country has been having for generations. But our nation's legacy of racial injustice is often obscured by our history books. That's left some people to ask, how did we get here and how can I learn more? Hermione Bell Henderson is the coordinator of business, technology, and periodicals at the Milwaukee Public Library. She's compiled a list of books to help adults and kids learn more about racism, racial injustice, and how to be an ally. Henderson joined me in June of last year to talk about her selections. So this first title, very blunt and probably a good starting off point for people. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Sure. So the first book is So You Want to Talk About Race by Ijeoma Alu. And it's really a book that focuses on the issues of Black America. It addresses everything head on and discusses topics such as privilege, police brutality, microaggressions, the popular Black Lives Matter movement, and even the N-word. It does so in a very raw and brutally honest way. And it really just gets you thinking about race.
Well, it sounds like something that unpacks a lot of the terms that we're hearing in a lot of different news reports and a lot of different commentators. When they say certain terms, I think some people just, you know, they don't have the education to really understand what's being talked about. And the next title that you have is actually, I would say, one of those phrases. White Fragility is the title of the next book.
Right. So the next title is White Fragility: Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism by Robin J. DiAngelo. And what is white fragility? It's really characterized by white people becoming uncomfortable when they are challenged with the topic of race. It focuses on the emotions of anger and fear and guilt. And there's kind of, you know, the two sides of what happens when you have an uncomfortable conversation. You know, you might get defensive and start arguing, but then the other side of that is that you might just go plain silent. And so it really examines whiteness and gives people an opportunity to change for the better and talk about what's uncomfortable and really have those meaningful conversations about race. It also allows people to really disrupt their beliefs, their principles, and just patterns that have been developed over time, not only in their own lives, but through history when talking about race.
So in that same vein, the next title, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Tell us a bit about that.
Sure. So Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America by Michael Eric Dyson is a title by a Black voice, who's been discussing race topics for a very long time. Tears We Cannot Stop really focuses on Black reality. It focuses on facing the difficult truths about what it's like to be Black in America, and really addresses how long that Black reality has really just been ignored, dismissed, and discounted here in America. It gives us a better understanding of the world that we live in, and that if we actually do face reality and the difficult truths of what it means to be Black in America, we can really go deeper and begin to take action to address finally what needs to be addressed.
Now, this next book, it has actually a local tie-in. I think people will be familiar with the author James Cameron as the founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum. This is an interesting title in part because it's such a personal story.
Correct. So James Cameron, in his book, A Time of Terror, A Survivor's Story, really gives that first person account of his 1930 arrest. At the time, he was 16 years old and he was out with his friends, and a mob got them and terrorized them and lynched his two friends. And he was nearly lynched, but he was fortunately able to escape. It's a very powerful story. And later in life, James Cameron went on to, again, like you said, become the founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum and really tell his story as a civil rights activist. So, you know, it wasn't too long ago, and for him to be able to share his story before he died, again, was very powerful.
And for people who might not be familiar with this incident that happened, it actually is a very famous photograph, the photograph of his two friends who were lynched, and it inspired a very big song, Strange Fruit.
Yes, it did. Yeah, very inspiring.
Yeah. So this next book, perhaps aptly after talking about A Time of Terror, is called Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption.
So Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption by Bryan Stevenson has really grown in popularity, especially since the movie is out. It really gives you that great visual representation of the book. The movie now features Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Foxx, but the story is the true story of Walter McMillan, who was convicted and sentenced for a crime that he didn't even commit. And so Bryan Stevenson was the lawyer, and he's a very influential lawyer who's behind the Equal Justice Initiative that has exonerated innocent death row prisoners. I believe at the time of this and just the current work of the Equal Justice Initiative, they have freed over 135 wrongly condemned prisoners on death row. But the story of Walter McMillan really just sheds light and is one of many true stories that highlights racism and our broken justice system.
Yeah. Now, this next book, I have to say, I really enjoy the title, in part because I think, you know, as somebody who is a white person in America and who grew up in a predominantly white area, sometimes, you're just a little stupid about things. You're just a little ignorant about things. And I like that the title is How to Be Less Stupid About Race. Like, you're still going to be a little stupid about it, but let's be less so.
Right. I picked the title just because it was a little fun, even though it is a heavy topic. But Crystal Fleming, the author, really gets down to helping us understand the historical roots of white supremacy, helps us draw connections between, you know, past racism and present racism. And then at the end, she is able to help offer 10 steps to help dismantle systemic racism. So a deep topic, nice and light title.
Well, and with that in mind, one of the things that we wanted to do inside of this list was include titles that would be accessible for teens and even children. And the next few titles all speak to a younger age group.
Correct. I know as a mom of two Black kids here in Milwaukee's, you know, the most segregated city in the nation, you know, I've had to, especially recently, have those tough conversations. And I found this book list to be helpful to me in explaining some of those things to my children. The first one is Not My Idea, a book about whiteness by Anastasia Higginbotham. And it's the story of a white child who sees a TV news report of a white police officer shooting and killing a Black man. And they talk about, the mom says, hey, in our family, we don't see color. But the child sees the colors very plain and simple. And so the story talks about uncovering the truth of white supremacy in America. But it's tailored very nicely because it's a book that's geared toward ages 5 through 12. So it goes deep, but it's still simple enough for the youngest readers.
Now, this next title is pretty blunt. Racism and Intolerance. Is that an overview more for children?
Yes, it is, I would say. So Racism and Intolerance by Louise Spilsbury really helps children get answers to the questions like, what does it mean to be a racist? Or what does it mean to be intolerant? And then how can I help? So children begin to understand the ways that others struggle with these issues. Everyone who reads these titles or this book can, you know, start to or become empowered to make a difference. So it's also a call for action for our young readers.
Now, this next title called Let's Talk About Race, it seems like a good, again, kind of an introduction for kids.
Right. So Let's Talk About Race by Julius Lester talks about race, but in poetic form. So it's a nice poetic introduction to the topic of race. There's a discussion about differences and unique features of races that can be celebrated while also discussing the important bond that everyone shares with one another. And then there's also discussion of, you know, we are bonded because we're human beings and, you know, we have many common similarities. So a great discussion. That's geared more toward ages 6 and up. So again, a very good read for the young children.
Well, in this next title on the same idea of poetry is Say Her Name Poems to Empower. What I like about this title is I think sometimes when we talk about topics that are as serious as racism, intolerance, racial discrimination, we can tend to lean away from the artistry of writing that I think often pulls people in. We tend to lean on nonfiction for very obvious reasons, but I like that this includes some of the artistic part of this dialogue.
Right. So Say Her Name, Poems to Empower by Zeta Elliott focuses on 49 poems. And some of the poets who contributed to this were inspired by the greats. So Nikki Giovanni or Phyllis Wheatley or Lucille Clifton. This book was also inspired by the Say Her Name campaign. So they pay tribute to victims of police brutality in a very uplifting kind of way with themes talking about self-love, Black resistance. It helps people and readers peek into the mind of what's it like to be a Black woman in America. And, you know, we hear through the protests and we hear through, you know, all these stories of police brutality that, you know, don't forget our Black women. So that's very important to shed some light and focus on Black women who are also going through the same things here in America. I like this book because it offers messages of hope and resilience to young readers. Like you said, also in a very creative format. So, you know, when we think of our young readers, we think about them wanting to express themselves in their own creative ways. So hopefully this type of book and poetry form will also inspire young poets as well.
Yeah. Well, Hermione, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much again for having me. I appreciate it.
Hermione Bell Henderson is the coordinator of business, technology, and periodicals at the Milwaukee Public Library. We spoke last summer. You can find the full list and information about where to find the books at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll tell you about a place in Milwaukee that specializes in therapy for Black, Brown, and LGBTQ people. Plus, we'll learn about the history of the Lake Geneva Playboy Club. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.